So is Jesus commanding us to hate our fathers, our mothers, our sisters, our brothers, and our children, and then on top of that, to hate ourselves? And of course, when you listen to that, that's what it sounds like. But this is the very typical thing that why I and not only I, the people who are in ministry and in the Catholic Church and hierarchy are always saying to us, learn to read the scriptures. Do not just pick them up without learning to read them. Now, what would be the mistake if we were to follow, if we were to say, hey, Jesus says exactly that. Unless you hate your mother, father, sister, brother, mother, sister, and children, and even your own life, you can't be a disciple. Can't be more plain than that. There it is. The problem, of course, is that if you don't study, you don't know how words were used at the time. Let me give you an example. This is a silly example, but it's an example that always has illustrated the point for me. I want you to imagine that I wrote a sentence on a piece of paper, and the sentence read something like this. It's raining cats and dogs, so let's burn some rubber and get downtown. Okay? Now, I want you to imagine I take that piece of paper, and I put it into time capsule. And 3,000 years from now, they pull out the time capsule. And then they look and they see, gosh, in Houston, Texas, 3,000 years ago, cats and dogs would fall from the sky. And they would achieve great speeds by burning rubber. What's the mistake? And of course, the mistake is very simple. They took something that we say, and they, instead of learning our slang, they took it literally. And actually, you can say that's what it says right there. But that's not what we meant at all. Well, that's the point that you have. Let's go back to the scriptures. Because when Jesus is speaking at that time, it was the word hate could be used literally as a word hate, but it could also be used by saying that you love something less than you love something else. And so the word hate, even when we use the word hate, like if you say, I hate broccoli, you don't really hate broccoli. You may not like it, but hatred is hardly the word to be used towards broccoli. But it's what's called a hyperbole. A hyperbole is when you exaggerate something to make a point. Okay? And there's hyperboles all over the place. Every time I kid, one of the hyperboles we're constantly using is awesome. Awesome. You know, and if you look at the word awesome, it means to be of such impression that it literally takes your breath away. It gives you awe. It's actually a religious word. But we use it for food. That was an awesome hamburger. You're exaggerating, and you need to learn to interpret that. So, what is Jesus saying? What Jesus is basically saying, and in Matthew, this is the Gospel of Luke, and in the Gospel of Matthew, Jesus says, it's the same thing, but Matthew puts it in different words. Matthew says, if you love father, mother, sister, brother, son, or daughter more than me, you're not worthy of me. So it's exactly the same saying. It's just that the two disciples are remembering it different. They're remembering the essence of what Jesus said, but they don't remember exactly the words. And think about it. If you were quoting a friend of yours, you can't necessarily remember the words. You can remember the exact meaning that he had, but you may use different words. Well, look at the context that is given. The gospel began by saying, in those days, there were crowds, there were many people following Jesus. And then he turned to them and he said, if anyone, da, 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 da. Now, what's the context? The context is that Jesus is saying, look, just because you sit and you listen to me and you think I'm an interesting guy, and just because you hang around seeing what I'm going to do, that doesn't mean that you can be my disciple. Now, Jesus is making a distinction between several levels of people. First of all, there's the crowd. Okay, and I want you to understand, I think that these levels of people still exist today. In every congregation, I'll apply it later, but in every congregation, there is these same levels of people. First of all, there's the crowd. The crowd is just people who are there because of different reasons. They may be interesting. They may have curiosity. Somebody may have dragged them, to come. And so in every congregation, there's a crowd. I can't tell. Everybody's here. We all look human, right? Then the second level are people who genuinely want to change their lives, but they have families at home. They have people that they're responsible for. Do you remember, for example, the rich young man who comes up to Jesus and he says, what should I do to gain eternal life? And what does Jesus say to him? Keep the commandments. These, and you will have eternal life. And the young man, it says, wishing to justify himself, he says, I've done this since I was little. What more can I do? Now notice, Jesus is not saying you are condemned if you don't do more. He is saying keep the commandments. And so the level at which the young man is at is being a faithful Jew. And Jesus has gone to the home of several faithful Jews that have not given up everything. If you remember Zacchaeus, the man who climbed up a sycamore tree, or Martha and Mary, who had their home, and they received people into their home. Okay? And so you have these disciples that are true disciples of Jesus, but they're at a different level. They're not just the crowd. It's the second level of that. But then Jesus is seeming to say another level. And another level is, and Jesus says it to the rich young man. He says, if you want to be perfect, not mandated, if you want to be perfect, sell everything you have and come and follow me. So, that level, because notice what the disciples had to do. All of the disciples that were members of Jesus' 12 disciples had to literally leave everything. Their businesses. They had to leave everything. And it cost them their lives. And so, Jesus is saying, if you want to be perfect. So, the question, then what you see is the three levels. And I think in these, we have that in every situation. In every congregation, there are those three levels. The crowd, the disciples, and those who want to be really perfect as disciples, who want to strive for that perfection. And not everyone can. But the answer is, well, can you strive for that perfection? And what if you're married And what if you have a home? And what if you have to provide for your kids? Well, the question would be, how did the first Christians interpret this? Because the first Christians, all of them had to have homes, all of them had to have places that they groceries and stuff like that to receive people. I'm not taking out my iPhone, I'm taking out my notebook. And I want to quote a passage for you from the letter, Paul's letter to the Corinthians. Listen to this. Now, this is 1 Corinthians chapter 7, verse 30. Now, the question is, must they leave all their possessions and follow Jesus? But what if you can't? So what do you do? And here is the interpretation of the Christian community in the first century by St. Paul himself. Paul says in 1 Corinthians chapter 7, verse 30, I tell you, my brothers, the time is running out. From now on, let those who have wives act as not having them. Those weeping as those not weeping. Those rejoicing as not rejoicing. Those buying as if not owning. Those using the world as not using it fully. For the world as its present form is passing away. So what's the answer? The answer is renunciation. Now, what does that mean in this context? It means that every Christian is called to be detached from stuff. You need to use stuff in your life. But there is no excuse, no matter what tier you are in, to live without detachment. That means that you understand that what God had, whatever you have in your life, including your body, your relationships, your wealth, your time, everything, does not belong to you. What are you doing? You are entrusted with it. You're entrusted with it. When somebody entrusts something to you, what does that mean? Like, for example, if I entrust you to represent me in court, does that mean that since you are there in my name, that you can do whatever you want? And the answer is no. You don't do whatever you want. My entrustment means that I think you know me well enough to act in my name as if it were me, so that you are choosing what you think I would choose. You are entrusted, so it's not your property. You can't do whatever you want. If I entrusted you with money, you cannot spend it on yourself because it's an entrustment. You do it in the name or in the spirit of what the other person would want. That is how every Christian is called to live. You're called to live remembering that nothing you own, and notice like the quotation marks. Why? Because nothing is yours. Nothing ultimately belongs to you. Everything belongs to God, and you are entrusted with it. And you make decisions according not to your own priorities, but to God's priority. Okay? And that's the whole point of what's being taught today, is that as disciples, we are not owners. That's why whenever we talk about money and whenever we talk about stewardship, and I'm not talking about that today, but just link it. What all of us have to do is say, here's what I own, and here's what I'm going to share, because this has been entrusted. It's been entrusted to you to take care of your family, but not selfishly. Okay? And so Jesus is saying to the crowds, he's saying, look, if you think being my disciple is just a matter of being a crowd that's listening to me, or being part of the crowd that goes to church, okay, because if you apply it here, at every mass, in every church, in every parish in this whole world, there are people there who have been dragged, who have no desire to be there, but they're sitting there, okay, I'll listen to Gio, I'll listen to Father Mario, how many times, so let's see how long he talks this time, okay? So, if you're part of the crowd, Jesus is saying, hey, you're welcome. You're welcome to be part of the crowd. Just don't think that that's what it means to be a disciple. Because the moment you are considering yourself a disciple, then obligations come upon your life. And the obligations are that you have to start learning to think like Jesus. See, that's what a lot of people miss. When people are asked, what are you? What religion are you? And they say, well, I'm a Catholic. Well, or I'm a Baptist, or I'm a Methodist, or whatever it is. That doesn't mean that you may be part of the Methodist crowd or the Catholic crowd, but that doesn't mean that you are a conscious disciple. Because the moment you are a conscious disciple, your first and foremost obligation is to begin to internalize the way that Jesus thinks. So that little by little, as you internalize that value system, which is very different from the system of the world, the moment that you begin to internalize, the whole point is that your behavior starts to change. And you begin to be more in the likeness of Jesus himself. Now, not all of us are going to be called to be a Franciscan monk or to be like Mother Teresa, you know, who was canonized today. Not all of us are going to be called to that. But every single one of us is called to live in this world not attached to the things that are passing. And so the important thing for us is to, you know, be honest with ourselves. You know, there's a lot of times that people would say, look, I'm not ready for real grace. There's a great man who I admire tremendously. His name was Dietrich Bonhoeffer. And Dietrich Bonhoeffer was a Lutheran minister during the rise of the Nazi Party and all during World War II. And Dietrich Bonhoeffer could not, in conscience, follow what the pathway that Germany was taking. And so he began to be part of the underground resistance to Hitler. And Dietrich Bonhoeffer, at the end of the war, 1945, a few weeks before the war ended, they took him out of prison where they had put them a year before. They marched him on the outside in the prison, and he was totally naked in the middle of winter, and they marched him up a gallows and strangled him and killed him. But why do I bring him up? Because Dietrich Bonhoeffer had this whole notion of cheap grace. Cheap grace. That's discipleship that doesn't cost you anything. You just want the cheap grace. I go to church and that's fine, but it's cheap. It just doesn't mean. And that's what Jesus is talking about. If you're going to be a disciple of mine, don't think there's such a thing as cheap grace. If you're going to be a disciple of mine, it's going to cost you. And it's going to cost you even to the point of costing you your own life. Or it's going to cost you that you're going to have to carry your cross you're going to have to take responsibility and follow me. And so it really is a challenge. It is a challenge. I think for too many times, and I want you to understand that there are, that these levels are, they've always been there. They've always been part of the crowd, and there's part of the disciples, and then there's part of the ones who really make the commitment to perfection. They've always been there, but you've got to be honest with yourself. People, that's why this whole notion, did you notice that Jesus uses the example of, if you're going to build a tower, don't you have to figure out that you have the financing? Don't you have to figure out how much labor you need? Otherwise, you're going to begin. In other words, count the cost before you start. Otherwise, be honest with yourself. Right now, I'm just part of the crowd that's sort of walking around behind Jesus because he's interesting or because I feel guilty. You know, whatever it is. But do it for that reason. And then when you really become serious about being a disciple, that's when you feel it in your life because it starts costing you, not money. It starts costing you changing and struggling to become the kind of mind, to have the kind of mind. And St. Paul says that we have to put on the mind of Christ. And that happens. It doesn't happen all of a sudden like that. It happens. A good friend of mine always says, God saves us over time and in layers. And it happens piece by piece by piece. But the hallmark of it is you take it seriously and you want Christ to literally change you from the inside out so that the decisions of your life look like they're made of a Christian. That's a good, I'll close with this. A good friend of mine used to ask this question on a retreat. He said, if someone accused you in a hostile society, if somebody accused you of being a Christian, would there be enough evidence to convict you? If someone accused you of being a Christian in a hostile society, would there be enough evidence to convict you? Interesting question.